2019. Global Star is another big one. Again, you can read all the information. And I always get in trouble when I start saying things like this, so I need to say this properly. There is concern in the industry that the Global Star satellites are relatively underpowered. Without going into a lot of explanation about how you figure out getting a signal to the ground, the energy management, the power management on board Global Star satellites is very tight. They have relatively small batteries to save weight, mainly. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can support the customers that they claim with the power budget that they have. The other interesting thing about Global Star, again, they pitch this as a good thing, and it may be, but it may also have to do with power management. Something called diversity combining. Global Star's signal is CDMA. We'll get into a tiny bit about CDMA later on. But basically the idea is that a Global Star handset can combine signals from more than one satellite. So if there's one satellite that all by itself was unable to deliver sufficient power to maintain a connection, Global Star can use two or three, as many as four satellites to send that conversation down to the phone and actually provide enough energy to keep the connection. It's an unusual feature, but they may have had to do it for power management reasons. EllipSat, this is the third of the four big LEOs licensed in the U.S. These are the ones who got a couple of patents on their orbital plan. Other than that, they're not terribly extraordinary. They also use CDMA. Again, you can read this. Keep in mind the apogee. I'm sorry that it's in kilometers to make it difficult to compare back to the notes. But in the next slide, you'll see their exciting plan for their orbit. Orbits come in a number of different flavors. The most popular one is a circular orbit, where the satellite is the same distance above the Earth throughout its entire path. But that's not the only choice. You can launch, and in EllipSat, they've decided to do this, to use elliptical orbits in that the distance changes throughout each revolution. The closest point is called the perigee, the highest point is called the apogee. The reason they're doing this is their customers, the people with the money, live in the northern hemisphere, bunched up in the land masses above the equator. Again, without going into orbital mechanics, the rule of thumb is that when you're moving through perigee, you're moving very quickly. When you're climbing up to apogee, you move very slowly. And so the time spent at apogee is longer than the time spent at perigee. So if your apogee is over your customers, is over, in this case, the northern hemisphere, you'll be able to use a fewer number of satellites to provide service to those customers. So this is the EllipSat's pitch, that by using this patented orbital set, they'll be cheaper because they'll have fewer satellites and be able to serve their customers as well as the constellations with a larger number of satellites. Is there any questions on any of this? What it means is, the question was, what does that mean if you travel the southern hemisphere? The issue is again, what's available to you. There's a lot of things going on here. One of the things that you have to do on board a spacecraft is power management. And the way that they've set up these satellites is that they'll be in recharge. They'll be charging up their batteries, and they'll be in a quiescent mode as they're over southern Atlantic and southern Pacific. If you're down there, it may be problematic to get service. It depends on how they decide to serve that. Their main focus, again, are the large customers on the land masses. If you're out on a ship in the middle of the ocean and it's just you, it may tell you you're out of luck. The question was the ellipsoid orbit modification of the Mol Naya. The system he's referring to is the Russian name. The orbits are that those particular satellites use is polar. Again, it's always difficult because I don't want to go into a lot of orbital mechanics, but basically, instead of staying above the equator, the orbit is tilted, so they orbit from pole to pole. In the case of Mol Naya, they are elliptical. But I think the specifics of the patent were not just the fact that it's elliptical, but that the configuration of all the satellites wasn't just we're trying to patent an elliptical orbit, but their particular configuration of it. HICO, as I said, is the spin-off of Inmarsat. It used to be called Project P, Project 21. It's another big LEO. Interesting mainly because of their orbital selection. They'll be medium Earth orbit. They'll gain a lot of advantages there. At these higher altitudes, you can see more of the Earth's surface at one time. So you get you need fewer satellites to cover the Earth. Your satellite lifetime is also longer, so they won't have to launch replenishments as often as some of the LEOs. We had big LEOs and we've got little LEOs. Little LEOs are defined as data only. They won't carry voice. They'll carry data and they typically operate in VHF and UHF. In the United States right now, there's five licensees that actually got their licenses in March for the most part. ORBCOMM is the big one. We'll see more about them in a little bit. ESAT and final analysis has one in orbit. Everybody else is still kind of building. Little LEOs are complicated because the VHF and UHF spectrum that they're using is very crowded. There's DoD satellites there. There's a French low Earth orbit system. There's NOAA weather satellites. There's some terrestrial stuff. And so the FCC spent a long time agreeing to a joint spectrum use plan. And you'll see why this is important later, but what basically happened was these five got together and decided, here's how we can all work together to use this spectrum. So they appeared before the FCC, said, here's how we're going to do it. FCC looked at it and said, okay, sounds fine. As soon as this becomes competitive, as soon as they reach their capacity limits, the spirit of cooperation may fade away. So this will be an interesting one to watch. The question was, has the spectrum been finalized? This is going to go into a little bit of radio administration. Worldwide, there are meetings that are held, usually in Europe, every few years, where representatives from communications entities across the globe get together and decide how to use frequency bands. The set of frequencies that LEOs are currently licensed to use has already been set aside worldwide. So that's established both here in the U.S. and across the globe. There's additional proceedings to gain additional spectrum, but the basic frequencies that they're using has already been set aside. ORBCOMM, the conglomerate of Orbital Sciences and a couple other companies. Right now, they have 12 satellites in orbit. There was actually a 13th that was a test model that they sent up in 91, which failed in a particularly unusual way. In 1995, they launched two of what they thought would be production models, and a few months later began offering commercial service. Although with only two satellites in low Earth orbit, your coverage is pretty poor. I think the average was under an hour a day, and you had to wait for it to come overhead. throughout that time that they were testing those two flight models, made a number of changes, and finally at the end of last year they launched 8 more. In February they got 2 more up. They've got 1 complete plane plus the other satellites scattered around. They are in current production right now. Yes. The flight model that they launched in 91 was, they got an experimental license for it, and there were a host of software failures that they didn't anticipate. And we'll see why their system is kind of complicated.
What caused the
path
to satellite
launch? I'm sorry? He's asking about what's the cost per pound to launch a satellite. That's a tricky question. I'm not sure I can give you a number that would be anywhere from hundreds of thousands. Orbcomm is a little unusual in that instead of launching a rocket from the ground, they have their what they call a Pegasus launcher. They put all their satellites in the nose cone of the Pegasus and strap it to the underside of an L-1011, and then the aircraft takes off and launches from 40,000 feet. So it's kind of an air-launched rocket. Now that doesn't do a lot for their cost, but it's more convenient to launch from an airstrip than a regular launch itself. Does that help? Orbcomm describes their satellites as orbiting packet routers. They're really relatively fairly small. They're only about 100 pounds. They look like a big movie film canister. When they deploy, the two lids open up, and those are the solar panels. There's a telescopic boom antenna that points down to the Earth. They do use packets. They try to stick with the X400 addressing standard. They call their messages global grams, so if you see that trademarked or registered somewhere, they're talking about Orbcomm. And there's 2 different ways this can operate. The satellite can operate as a relay. If the subscriber is in view of the satellite, and that satellite can see an Earth station, you can move a packet of about 2,000 characters, and that's a relay mode. If the satellite can't see a ground station, it'll do what's called storm forward. It'll accept a 200-character message and hang on to it until it's over a gateway and then down like this. And some of that software to do that has been through some revisions. One of the things I'm asked is, is there anything hands-on? The interesting thing about little LEOs is that they're operating in the VHF and UHF range, and for the past 2 decades you've been able to get receivers at Radio Shack or other places that can scan that band. It also happens to be very close to the amateur radio 2-meter band, so there's a lot of equipment out there. If you want to get started in listening to these guys, I've just put down an overview of the kind of things you'll need. 1 is a receiver. Scanner typically works fine. The downlink frequencies, we'll see Orbcomm in particular, but the subscriber link downlink for the little LEOs is in the 137 to 138 megahertz range. And you'll need a bandwidth of anywhere to 25 to 50 kilohertz. The biggest variable is the antenna. I'll show you one that's given pretty good results. The rubber ducky that you usually get with most handhelds, depending on where you are, it may work, but in most cases you'll probably be pretty disappointed. The other complicated part, although it's getting a lot easier, is running orbital predictor software. Since these are little LEOs, they're not in the same place all the time. So what you need to do is get what they call two-line elements, or TLEs. These are available on the internet from a number of websites. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, at least until recently, had a web page that had these on it. You feed these in, they're in the standard format. They're in the data file, you feed them into the orbital predictor software, tell the software where you are, and it'll tell you where the satellites are, where you've got to look to find them. And again, if you have any particular questions, I'd be happy to talk about it afterward. This is an antenna that gives pretty good performance without you having to actually track satellites. In other words, you don't have to know particularly well where the satellite is. This is an M2 EB1. It's made by M squared. It's an EB124 egg beater. That's what it looks like. There's a six-element ground plane that helps immensely. I don't know if you can see it. The one I got from RadioWare, www.radio-ware.com. If you talk to Craig, he'll help you out. Runs about $150 and does real well in this VHF area. I think those are reversed. Is there one of monitoring? Okay. We'll start with this one. These are the downlinks in VHF, as I said, between 137 and 138. They're broken up into different bands. Again, this is part of the licensing that was set up. The feeder link runs at a much higher speed at a particular frequency. All this information is on my website that I'll give you the URL for at the end. Uplinks are in the reverse direction. So another typo on this one that's been corrected. Again, VHF range. Subscriber links, mainly due to power, run at a very low baud rate, so made for interesting listening. And again, all these frequencies will be on the web page. A number of these systems, both Big LEO and Little LEO, are running CDMA. They're running spread spectrum, and in talking to people over the past couple of days, there have been a lot of questions about it, so I wanted to at least talk a little bit about this. The usual way that information is transmitted by RF is by what they call narrow band. It's a narrow area frequency. There's a lot of energy buried in there. It's easy to find, easy to see. Receivers are designed to pick that up. Direct sequence spread spectrum kind of turns that on its ear. Rather than focusing all the energy in that narrow area, they spread it out across a much wider frequency band. The blue bubble is where that would be. The interesting characteristic about it is that it sits below the noise floor. If you turn on a radio and just tune to a place where there's no station, you'll hear hiss and static. That's basically your noise floor. CDMA is very interesting to the military because those signals sit below the noise floor. If you were just tuning a receiver around, you'd have a very difficult time knowing that signal was even there. So the little acronym of their LPI, LPD, is low probability of intercept, low probability of detection, and it makes CDMA very attractive to military users. It's also very attractive to commercial users for the fact that you can run multiple CDMA signals in the same frequency band. In fact, the Globalstar satellites run all their beams at the same frequency. The ability to run CDMA also has an interesting feature around covert channel, which I think is covered on the next slide. Again, most satellites are bendpipe relays. They don't know what information is coming in. They don't know its format. They don't know anything about it. They just take a band of frequencies, take it from one area, usually down convert it, transmit it back down to the ground. If you're a television station and you want to send your video out to your affiliates, you rent time on a satellite. You call up the satellite operator. You say you want to rent a transponder for an hour. They give you the information, and you send your information, typically narrowband, as the legit. The covert channel, again, since these bendpipe relays are running all the time, as long as the transponder on the satellite is powered up, it will relay whatever it sees, including any CDMA signals that may be emitted from the ground. The satellite operator, if he even notices, will see a slight increase in the noise floor. But the satellite, unless it's doing some unusual filtering, will relay the CDMA signal just fine. This has, I would say it has interesting potential, but that implies that nobody's done it yet. I don't want to say that. From my position, I can't encourage that. I'm just saying there's no reason it wouldn't work. She had a particular comment about listening before sending. The issue about CDMA is if you're spread far enough and you're, again, I don't want to get too far into this, but the codes that you're using to do the spreading, as long as they're good codes, you won't be noticed even if there are other people using it. Again, all they'll see is a slight fractions of a dB increase in the noise floor. They'll never even know. This was a particular media issue back in May. Pan Am Sat's Galaxy 4 decided to go on a little joyride, and everybody lost their pagers. So I got a lot of questions about, does my pager get messages straight from the satellite? It's not quite how it works, although Iridium plans on offering a paging service, which is direct satellite to subscriber pager. The way most of these systems work is that there's a paging terminal and an uplink that use the commercial satellite, and it really doesn't use that much bandwidth. My memory serves, I think you can handle about a million numeric pagers on a 4800 BPS link. So this isn't terribly high bandwidth, but the uplink is rebroadcast down to individual paging towers. And those paging towers then rebroadcast all the pages in a particular area. The reason it took a long time to switch over to the alternate satellite is that they had to send technicians out to each of those paging towers and repoint the antennas to the alternate satellite. And that's really irritating at 3 o'clock in the morning. This is the Galaxy 4 is based on a Hughes 601 model satellite. The detail on this, I really didn't come out terribly well, but this is kind of a cutaway of a 601. And you can see at the bottom some of the customers who've used the 601 as a base for their particular satellite. Website and email address. Most of the information on these slides, maybe not in this exact form, will be on that website. You can send me an email at that address. I guess I've got another few minutes or so if there are any particular questions or any. I'm sorry. The website URL is www.decode.com. You can send mail to me, dan@decode.com. That's an interesting issue. He's asking about remote administration of these systems, which is a little bit different from onboard processing. One of the things with satellites that you have to keep in mind is that there's really two completely separate communications paths going on. The one path that you saw in the beginning was the subscriber link and the feeder link, and that's how they make their money. The other communications link is the what they call the TTNC, the tracking, telemetry, and control. And those typically operate at much different frequencies. The issue that you refer to about remote administration, one of the interesting things about this is that right now there's probably a little over 300 commercial satellites in geosynchronous orbit of one kind or another. In the next few years, just the big LEOs are planning on launching about 200. So in a lot of areas, it's going to start to get pretty crowded. And that creates some problems for ground controllers for two reasons. One is, suddenly there's a whole bunch of them. And it's going to be difficult to control each of them all at the same time. The other thing is that controllers right now, the only operators who have a lot of experience flying LEOs are military people. Commercial operators have spent most of their lives trying to keep a satellite in one place rather than trying to steer it in a LEO. With Iridium in particular, one of the things that they're very proud of is that they reduced their reliance on ground controllers. There's a lot of autonomous modes that the satellite can go into. For instance, when it's launched, there's a deploy mode where there's really not much interaction from the ground controller. The satellite pretty much on its own unfolds, sets up, does self-tests, acquires the sun, acquires the earth, contacts ground stations all by itself. More interestingly, at Iridium end of life, there's a deorbit mode where, with not much interaction with ground controllers, it shuts down and fires its retros and burns up in the atmosphere. So there, if you've listened to any of Rich Schneier's talks or anybody, it's a similar security issue that the more intelligence, the more automatic intelligence you're putting in the satellite, the more opportunities there are for things to go wrong.
Any information as to how it decides to go into the overcoat?
Is that thing, how it decides? According to Iridium, it's carefully controlled. But I'm sure most of you here have written software. It's all software. I mean, the deorbit software is not different from the configuration software. It's all sitting there. I'll let you multiply it out. What he's asking about is essentially capacity, is how many people can this thing support at one time. In satellites, you're not typically bandwidth limited. Usually you have as much bandwidth as you want. The problem is power. So most satellites are power limited. I was hesitant on going into this, but there's a mathematical process you go through to develop what's called a link budget, which is you start with power. If you're doing a downlink, you start with the power that's available on board the satellite, and you start subtracting out things, atmospheric problems, and so on, until you get down to the ground inside the subscriber terminal. The particulars, right now I'm kind of awash in a set of numbers. There's information on my webpage about what each system claims they can support. And again, as I was saying about Globalstar, power management is going to be an issue in that they'll have far more bandwidth than they will have power. And so the electrical state of the satellite will be the determining factor about how many customers they can support. But makes sense. He's asking about what I mentioned before about the orbital prediction software and where to find it. There's an amateur organization, Amateur Satellite Association, www.amsat.org. If you go in there, they've got links to a lot of different home pages for developers who've got a lot of different programs. I know there's, easy to say this, but there's Windows 95 and Windows NT software. I think there's Linux software, so there may be both. But that's probably where I would go to start, either that or AltaVista. He's asking about Y2K problems. And this is not just in the satellite industry, the problem with Y2K is that you can't really say anything without your lawyer wanting to kill you. So all you can say is, Y2K, we're making our best effort. We'll find out. He's asking about how you receive and how you essentially demodulate a signal that's below the noise floor. And this gets into how direct sequence spread spectrum works. I'll try to simplify this. The data signal is, each bit of your data signal is turned into a series of what they call chips. So you've got a whole string of chips. The chips are in a particular pattern. So what you do is when you send it, you're sending these patterns of chips. At the receiving end, if you match that pattern, you do what's called correlation, and you get the bits back. But you have to know that code, and you have to know that the signal's there. You're asking about authentication for TPNC. Let me say that military is better than commercial. It's one of those places where people start to get funny. Typically, when you buy a satellite, you go to a provider. You don't just buy the satellite. You buy the satellite. You buy the ground station. You buy all the gear that goes along with it. You buy a contract to do in-orbit support, a whole bunch of stuff. And so the command protocols and the authentication usually comes in a package, and they call that proprietary. If I say too much more, I'm going to get into a lot of trouble. She's asking about Teledesic, the Bill Gates network. That's another category. What I've got here is big LEOs, little LEOs. Those are being called broadband LEOs. They'll provide multi-megabit data rates from orbits and all these things. The Teledesic plan, the original investors included Craig McCaw, who's a big, he founded McCaw Cellular, made a lot of money when he sold it to AT&T. Bill Gates is also an investor. There's a Saudi prince and a bunch of other people. That system started out with a plan of launching 800 satellites in low Earth orbit to provide this. They've got it whittled down to 288 now. That's a lot of launch. As far as real progress, Boeing has signed on. They launched their, under cover of secrecy, they launched actually their first satellite that looked a lot like the Orbcomm satellites. It was launched under the name BATSAT, B-A-T-S-A-T. That was their hidden name. And that's basically a test model. And they want to find out whether it's going to work or not. And they're very tight-lipped about what's going on, and you know they do weird things about making their announcements. He's asking about the size of the user terminals. Anybody who watched CNN probably saw Peter Arnett sitting next to the big dish. What he was using most likely was an Inmarsat terminal, which comes in a couple briefcases and is about $30,000. It's checkable luggage, and you have to set it up when you get there. Globalstar and Iridium handsets are going to be bigger than a cell phone, but not a lot bigger. They've done mock-ups. Motorola and another manufacturer are building them for Iridium. And since Iridium is going to turn on in September, they're already in the pipeline. They're probably about the size of one of the early Motorola brick phones, or roughly that size. They'll have a thicker antenna, because they're operating at much higher frequencies, but it's supposed to be handheld. He's asking about the failed Iridium satellite. I've got a little table on my webpage that talks about what happened. There were some anomalies. One was once lost because there was a stuck thruster, depleted all its fuel. Another one got tangled in a blanket from the launch cone, so it's tumbling. Almost all the others have failed for hardware or electrical reasons on board. At least that's the claim. The best place to find out about that is probably Iridium's SEC filings, Security and Exchange Commission. As we say, you can lie to the FCC, but you can't lie to the SEC. So reading their reports is probably a better place to go. Now, both Big LEOs and Little LEOs are required by FCC regulations to file a yearly report on such things, on failures, on loss of service, on outages. It's not on the web as far as I can see. The FCC's got a reading room on M Street in D.C., but I haven't seen any of it on the web. He's asking about the equipment to use to demodulate these signals. Not everybody's using the same stuff, but the TNC is the right idea. All this, I'm trying to remember which way it goes, either the uplink or the downlink. One way is FSK, one is BPSK. So it's fairly easy to get the bits out. What they don't want to tell you is what the bits mean, you know, what goes where. So that you may have to kind of suss out for yourself. He's asking, what do you see when you monitor this? Specific with ORBCOMM, they send small packets of information back and forth, so you're seeing little packets coming in. The thing to keep in mind when you're looking at this is, again, there's two things you can look at. You can look at the subscriber link and you can look at the feeder link. The subscriber link, subscribers pay on a per character basis. So if you're using this, it pays to keep your packet small and really compress things down. There's one of the early ORBCOMM setups was monitoring the level of a lake. And so their sensor that measured the depth of the lake converted that depth into a single character and sent that one character every so often. So what you'll see most likely won't make a lot of sense to you for what's existing now. What's coming out, it's been delayed and re-delayed and re-delayed, but a device by Magellan called the GSC-100, a big handheld unit that will let you send and receive email messages. There's some of those that are floating out in beta right now, and the information on that is most likely a lot more readable than any of the telemetry kind of stuff that's going on now. He's asking how much more time is spent over apogee versus perigee in an elliptical orbit. I don't recall the particular numbers for ellipsat. If I sat down with the numbers, I can work it out. There may be some information on ellipsat page about that. There's a link to it on my page. Again, if you really want to know, I can sit down and work it out. Sorry, I keep ignoring the side of the room. I don't mean to, but...
Actually,
two things here. The satellite lifetime in deorbit,
is that basically fuel, thruster fuel? And what about the meteor shower propel scheduled for the end of this year? How much of that do you believe?
He's asking about two different things. One is satellite lifetime. and satellite lifetime is typically measured in the amount of maneuvering fuel that you've got on board. You launch a satellite and you fill up these tanks with hydrazine or pressurized nitrogen or some gas that you can eject to push you around. Once you run out of gas, obviously you can't push anything around anymore. So for LEOs, that may be a limiting factor, although it may turn out that a lot of them will fail for other reasons. And this is another complicated portion of the LEOs. Up to this point, satellites have basically been built by hand. They're a custom job. Everything's checked out, double, triple check. If you're going to be building several dozen satellites, as Iridium and the other companies are doing, you build them on an assembly line. And there's been industry talk, back to your question, about the reliability of building satellites on an assembly line, in that maybe we really don't know all we need to know about putting several dozen together at once rather than building in onesies and twosies. The other question was about the Leonids. There's a meteor storm every so often that the Earth moves through. There's a lot of media coverage about these meteorites are going to cream all the satellites in orbit. And, it's happened in the past. Right now, I think NORAD's tracking a little over 8,000 objects in orbit. There are space debris, anything from ball size on up. There have only been two known collisions between space debris and something else. So I think that my personal guess is that it'll blow on by. Somebody might get hit. You could buy insurance for it, and there are already agents out selling policies. So we'll see. And it'll be interesting. Don't even get me started on satellite insurance. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
What I understand, the satellites, the meteors that are coming in are going too slow to damage the satellite. That mostly might break a few solar cells off of them. But something that you have to have much smaller density material, like something like X-rays or something like that, to use that it needs the satellite itself. This is what I understand from people who actually work on these objects. So a meteor shower is not that much threat than something like a solar collector.
I don't know if everybody heard that. Just basically that he had heard that the estimates of damage would be fairly light because of the characteristics of the meteor storm. All I can say is that even the geostationary satellites are moving 7,000 miles an hour. They're moving very quickly in any case. So even hitting something very small has a good chance of doing something serious. Solar flares are more hazardous because of the radiation effects rather than the physical kinetic effects. It's after 11 seconds. Two more questions. He's asking about the elliptical one, which is actually ellipsat. ICO is in a circular orbit. It will pass through some of it, and so that's also been an issue about satellite lifetime. How long is this going to last going through radiation belts over and over? So you're right, that is an issue. One more. Some of the bands for TT&C, all over, usually C band, there's some KU band. It's really particular to the satellite. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it.